Hello?
Oh, hey, Gerardo. Sorry, I forgot to turn up the aux.
No, don't worry.
I was like, why don't I hear him?
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you great. actually, Bella, can you just double check that you can also hear on the headphones? So, Gerardo, you're our first official live call.
Call-in?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
So I think
Wait,
it works.
So this is live?
This is live. You're on the radio at the moment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I did it once with Kevin, but it was like late at night because he is in Tokyo and nobody was listening, so I was less worried about it working. Yeah, what's happening?
Not much. Just got my hair cut.
Nice.
So good start to the day.
Solid. Did you get a chance to jump in the water this morning?
Not today. I bypassed that just to get the haircut. It was kind of driving me crazy, so I needed to get that done.
Those are like those key decisions you have to make.
I mean, it's an important thing.
So when we announced, obviously, you were going to be on, I told people you're on a secret island. And we'll sort of leave it at that. Gerardo?
Cutting out a little bit.
Can you hear
me?
Yeah,
can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, let me know if we'll just call you back. This is real makeshift.
All right. I'm going to stay in one place just to make sure.
Thanks. So yeah, we told people that, you know, you were going to call in from a secret island somewhere in the ocean. And we left it at that, so we don't have to get into details about your kind of next adventure that you're on.
The secrecy.
Yeah, the secrecy.
Yeah.
But as I say, it's really exciting, and I feel very lucky that I get to know a little bit about it and have kind of gotten a sense of what you're doing. So, but thanks for calling in. So basically, what we're doing is obviously just talking to a bunch of amazing artists and really interesting people, and especially artists of color and chefs of color, musicians and stuff. And it's primarily not only about what you're doing now, but kind of how you got here, with the kind of explicit intent of any kids, or frankly, like young designers, anybody really that wants to potentially be like you, you know, in a way, this is how you did it. And so they can see someone that maybe looks like them and kind of get excited about that.
Yeah, how's it going so far?
It's rad. It's really, really fun. It's way more time consuming than I think any of us had thought about.
It seems like on the hour, every hour, there's a new guest, right?
Well, it's getting busier too. Originally, we were just trying to do two a day.
Because
I was like, we still have like an office to run. We still have work to do. And then as it started picking up steam and people were hearing about it, and we were getting excited about it, we kept inviting more people on, and so now it's like four a day.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
I was wondering, because it's literally from like 10 a.m. till like 3 p.m., right?
Till 6.
Till 6, shit.
Yeah, yeah, it's
How do you
day.
Guys get anything done?
For any clients listening, it's no problem at all. No, it's honestly, well, so luckily the office is a block away. And
yeah.
So anybody that's not really directly involved with that day's radio, we try to keep them out of the radio station room, the space, because it is very, like, there's always people around and people coming in and out, and it can be very easy to get distracted. But, like, Bella and I are basically here all day, so we just run back and forth all the time or have meetings here. But that was also kind of the point. Like,
I mean,
we built it out as a workspace so that people could come and work here, so we do that as much as we can.
It looks amazing, and I will say that not much would make me want to change my location at the moment, but I definitely am missing out not checking out. It looks great.
Oh, thank you.
All the photos I've seen.
I appreciate that. I do not blame you. Knowing where you're at, it's a good place to stick around for a little while.
How's the weather up there?
Yeah, not anything. It's we don't need to talk about it.
All right. I mean, I'm picturing it too, because you know, since we met over the summer, it's really funny because, like, I live in Chinatown, and my window, I'm on like a seventh floor facing Bowery. And I swear the week after I met you, when I came back to New York, literally, I would see you all just walking down that street. Like,
just enjoying the weather.
Yeah.
I think with the dog, I think there was one day you mentioned. Yeah.
Yeah. There totally was a dog.
Yeah. I feel like I got really lucky that we met while you were still here.
Totally.
That was sick. So you, besides this kind of secret project, before that, I know you were at Lolito for a long time. When did you kind of transition from El Rey into Lolito?
I was at El Rey from 2013 till 2016.
Okay.
And then the same year that I left El Rey, I opened Lolito, kind of like 6 months later.
Damn.
And that was from 2016 to 2018. So
okay. So
not all a of super long time, but
right. But enough to obviously like, I mean, what I was really impressed with, I remember when Lolito first opened, because like Winnie's was there, so the location that you guys are in was sort of like an institution in the area.
And it's kind of, yeah, it was like sacred space.
Yeah, and I was like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, I know.
But what's funny is like, actually, I remember I talked to you about this. I had the same reaction with Scars when it first opened. Scars was a little different because I think that was much more about the sort of throwback vibe to it.
Yeah.
And same thing, like, this seems a little, but both, I mean, Scars and Lolito have now become just complete neighborhood go-tos.
Yeah, both of which you can get the same Caesar salad.
Really?
Yeah, the vegan Caesar came along before I left El Rey. Scar came to me and
no
was
way.
Like, I want a vegan Caesar.
That
and,
is your Caesar salad at Scar's?
Yeah, yeah, oh, wow. Yeah. It was a proud moment of 2016, I would say. I was really obsessed with making that dressing.
I had
in
no
particular.
Idea. It's gotten to the point where now when I go to Scar's, I almost always get the Caesar salad.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, that's awesome.
I think I got it once just because we were a bunch of people, and I, for some reason, I was like, I feel like we need some greens at this table.
Yeah.
And that's your option there, obviously. But ever since then, it's kind of, you know, I almost feel like sometimes I go there for that. And I feel like I have to have a piece of pizza because it's Scars.
Yeah, to balance it.
But I have
mean,
no
he's
idea.
Smart
Sorry?
In that sense.
Yeah, it's a good move. But thank you for the salad then.
Yeah, anytime.
Oddly, I've never had it at Lolito.
Thanks to Scar. Yeah. I think there might be a secret project in the works with that as well. So.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
I think it.
That'd be amazing. So I would love to know, I think... just a kind of quick recap. So then you left Lolito, I guess this year, basically. Did you go directly into this new project of yours?
Kind of. I mean, this kind of came about just out of nowhere. And I think, honestly, it was just more so I needed kind of a little shift in my life a little bit, and I didn't realize it at the time, but this kind of like little shakeup happened, and I just so it wasn't like directly right after, but I would say that like I kind of needed to take a little break towards the end of last year, and then I just was fortunate enough to like travel my ass off this year and kind of ended up on at this point. So
was that travel for fun or for kind of in prep for this project?
It was kind of everything. It was like I was fortunate that it's kind of wild, honestly, like it's the wildest year, 2018, for me, because I don't even know how to explain it. I have this really really good friend, actually she's like family, Fabiana from Coming Soon. She's Venezuelan, and they have this tradition where you have to like at New Year's Eve you go run around the street with a suitcase, and it's an omen for like good luck for travel the next year. And I don't know what fucking suitcase we had this year, but like for all of us that did it, it's just been like a crazy year for travel.
Did you do that in Venezuela, the running around with a suitcase?
No, we did it in Chinatown, I think.
Damn.
I think we did it on Bayard Street. I mean, it's a tradition that we've been doing for quite a while because of her, but this year just really like set off. So it was a good combination of like a lot of things in my past just kind of came into like fruition in this like really amazing organic way. Like one of the first things that I did this year was very blessed and lucky to my good friend Danielle Levitt, who is a photographer. She got married in New Orleans, and I catered her wedding. Huh. In a really, really beautiful space. It was an opera house.
Okay.
And so that kind of like kicked it off. And then since then, I've been like in LA. I've been like in London a couple times, and literally like all over the Caribbean, like starting in Trinidad, going to Barbados, St. Lucia, St. Vincent, Jamaica, meeting some like really amazing people, like really, really great people. This, it's just like totally, this whole year has kind of like come out of left field, and it's been pretty awesome in that sense.
Also Times Square. Don't forget about Times Square.
Oh yeah, Times Square. Yeah. So I just, yeah. You know,
so if people don't know, just on the side, Gerardo was also in like a gigantic billboard sized H&M ad in Times Square.
Yeah.
Just to fill some
you
time.
Had, well, yeah, there you go. Just in between. I snuck that
it
in.
Was amazing.
Yeah, I kind of joke around that like 2018 was the year we all got billboards. Because like, I know probably multiple people that you've had on have had billboards. This year, which is a whole other discussion. Yeah, yeah, it's just, you know, real people, I guess.
And that could be season two.
Yeah, that's it.
So can you get into more detail real quick before we kind of move on the suitcase tradition for anybody that wants a year like yours?
I mean, that's what I'm saying. I don't know what the hell was, which suitcase or what the hell we did. But okay, so you grab the suitcase. At midnight, you have to, like, I think you just have to run around a block with a suitcase. And I think it's got to be, like, it's got to be packed. It's one of those things where it's, like, literally, like, hold money in your hand and you'll get rich kind of thing. Or, like, it's just all those kind of, I guess, not superstitions, but, like, you know, like, omens or preemptive kind of, like, good luck charms.
That's amazing.
So you just do that. And then a week later, you will nonstop travel for literally, I think I counted. It was just like kind of on average, it's like a flight every week to some other place.
It's just kind of like training. Maybe it's not even superstitious. It's just training for that running around with a packed suitcase.
I think also it's kind of a little payback or. I don't want to say karmic, but like when you're a cook, you're kind of like there comes a point in your career when you have to like essentially you have no life for a good amount of time. And so I didn't travel for a really long time and it bummed me out to no end. And I think this is kind of like the makeup for that.
Huh. So was it hard to leave Lolito in terms of, I mean, it wasn't like, I guess it was only a couple of years, but it seemed like it was very much you in that place, like everything about it seemed very much you.
It was hard. I think I am really proud of everything that everybody's kind of accomplished there, and it was kind of the funniest like mixed bag of people, as far as like all different backgrounds, from the people that were cooks, the chefs, the servers, the owners, my partners, and all that kind of stuff. And it was really kind of an interesting, I mean, opening a restaurant is always tricky and always kind of hard. And I always kind of feel that like, it's one of those things where like you build up to something that you're going to open, and whatever idea you had of like what it was going to be can be completely annihilated and completely different 3 months after you kind of opened. And that's just like, adjusting to certain, you know, like the wants of customers or the needs of guests and all that kind of stuff. But it was, it was a difficult process. I think it was kind of a difficult year for me in a lot of ways. Just, I think it was a lot different than El Rey. And I'll say that in the sense that like El Rey was kind of like, I totally just gave my all to everything as far as like sacrificing my personal life and my finances and everything to this project that was like very much an extension of myself. I think almost like a little biosphere of me on this tiny little coffee shop. And the difference is in that last year, I kind of just had some, what that sacrifice kind of meant.
Right.
And also at the same time, I think more of political awareness or just like becoming more self-aware of like what my participation, I guess, in this industry was. And then also just like politically, everything just kind of changed too. Like literally Lolito opened 2 days after election day, the presidential election. So it's like, it's, I mean, that's kind of like the biggest downer you can ever have in that regard. So it just, it was a big, like, I don't know. I feel like there's kind of like a seismic shift I could see like all around me culturally. And personally, I was just going through a lot of stuff too. And so I'm very, very proud of like everything that's accomplished there. And I think currently there's some really amazing people that are running the show, and they're just kind of like taking it into the direction that it needs to go. But there's a really, really amazing woman named Carla who's been there since day one, and she's the general manager, and she is a New York native from the Bronx, and she's a really incredible person. Like, she puts her all, and she, I don't know, it's just like really refreshing and amazing to see someone kind of real go for it. And like, you know, I think she kind of started more as like a front door person, and now she's like running the place. And it's, to me, that's incredible. And then another woman named Kia moved from Florida to kind of, who ended up just kind of taking over the kitchen. And like, it's funny, I met her like through Instagram.
That's amazing.
As stuff kind of happens, like she was a cook down in Florida, and I think there's just mutual respect and admiration for each other for what we do, and then we just kind of connected, and they visited in New York over the summer last year, and like I don't know, just like the total, this community of like chefs kind of embraced her, and it's like I'm just really excited to see what they do. I know it's like owning a restaurant and running a restaurant is very, very hard, and it takes a lot. So I have much respect for them for taking it on and continuing it.
I mean, that was something. So I've you and just met Angela, who was here a couple weeks ago, and just starting to meet or get introduced, I guess, a little bit to the food and chef world. And something that was really
funny
apparent.
World.
It's a funny world, but actually something, and maybe it's just particular to the world, like your specific community, but the kind of familial aspect of every, like there's so much love in there, and actually so much like closeness, it seems anyway, amongst certainly your group of chef friends and the people that are like on the satellite fringes of that. Is that pretty common in your kind of experience anyway in the food industry in general, or are you guys really just a particular like brother sisterhood of like,
well,
buds?
Angela and I are funny because like we have all these like really wild like parallels in our lives as far as like just the things that come our way. It's like they're almost like identical versions of themselves but also like completely different. But it's just really funny because we're both like, anytime something happens that's kind of major, and then it literally will happen to the other person in a different way, but we'll both be like, whoa, this is great, because now we both have like something that we can commune and like talk about as far as like how we navigate that kind of thing. But I got to meet Angela in like 2013-14 at El Rey, because she was then the executive chef of Mission Chinese, and this was before the big one on East Broadway, was when it was on Orchard Street. So we were neighbors, and we just kind of clicked.
That's
and
awesome.
We've been really close since then.
I feel it's like a Californian thing too.
Yeah, I mean, we used to joke that was like that street, what was it, Stanton Street in between Ludlow and Orchard, was kind of like little San Francisco, because it was just like we both lived there in San Francisco, and we're both from California, so it's kind of like we have that always bond people,
right?
Californians,
it's true, it's funny, it's like literally as soon as that comes up you're like, oh, that's why we're getting along.
Yeah, totally. It's like it's stronger than a sign. It's like you're born on this. So I think things have changed a lot since we first met too, because at that time when we met, I think kitchen culture and chef culture was pretty much, I don't want to like generalize it, but it was I don't know, it was just kind of nerdy and a little bit bro-y, and which is fine, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think you're always taught it was a certain way, which is like also a very like Eurocentric, French-centric right. idea of like what it means to like make food for people. And there's nothing wrong with, I guess, discipline and structure and organization. In fact, I think people secretly, all people thrive on it. But there is something that's kind of like, it's just a very like, it's a system that's just outdated right. in a way. It's very like patriarchal. It's very like intense and like live by the fire kind of right. thing. And it's really like, I don't know what happened, but collectively a lot of people started to just kind of like, I think, I mean, it was just a lot of like people of color, a lot of queer people, a lot of women, like just, I don't know, just, I don't know if it's like we just got over it or it's just kind of like, let's move on to the next thing. And you're starting to see food kind of like go into more, I don't know, like respectability, I guess, or just on a level with like art and fashion and in a way that didn't really exist before. Because like food was always like part of that scene, but like it was kind of somewhat of an afterthought.
Right. Well, I was wondering because like, I mean, it's funny, there was that whole, the whole wave of celebrity chefs anyway, you know, like the kind of Ramsay and that, that mm-hmm. kind of era of celebrity chef was very much, in my mind anyway, not coming from the food industry, but like was that sort of like big, loud, white male.
Yeah, like yelling at you and like
yelling at you and just sort of like really boastful, like big personality, loud personality, but also like the food was rooted in, like you said, some kind of Eurocentric or French specifically centric kind of way of cooking.
Yeah.
Like I picture all of them just like head to toe tattoos and at best like they're kind of taking that stuff into you know, like the new American cooking, but it was all sort of a lineage from that. And then obviously I hadn't really thought about it until you just brought it up, but it totally seems like there's that sea change is really apparent now that there's this new wave of types of restaurants and types of chefs that are not Western centric and led, let's just exactly. say, by a much more eclectic and diverse group of chefs or type of chefs.
Or dining experience, too. And, like, yeah, everything about that. So, like, it's really cool because you see a lot of, you see a lot of, like, younger people kind of use it, especially first and second generation kids, like, kind of use it as a tool to explore identity, either self-identity or identity politics within their culture.
Right.
And I think that's a very beautiful thing because I always just feel like assimilation can be kind of like a low key kind of violent act.
Right.
That's very sneaky. So it's kind of a way to like continue a legacy and continue. That's a whole nother conversation about like exploring identity. But that's one of the big things I think that has been really amazing to see across the country and to see people feel empowered and use food as a tool to connect to other people and to commune with other people and to also take pride and celebrate where they come from that whole process, which blows my mind. It's so insane because it's completely different from how food was when I kind of first started. So that's rad, and that's.
What do you think changed? Because it is of all the kind of, let's say, creative industries that we've been talking to, I think on the show especially, but like the food world, the chef world does seem like unquestionably now one of the most eclectic and diverse, and the individuals there, you can like, it is very much tied to your own identity, and it's like the identities are celebrated and brought out. You're not really getting in line with that the kind of classic type of food anymore, and
food. Yeah. I mean, food is wild in that kind of creative sense because it's like you can go from so many different angles. There's like it's political, it's science, not only in just like how we grow food, but like what it does to our body. It's nutrition, it's sustenance, it's art, it's fashion, it's architecture. It's like it's so many things, which is amazing. And I think what you see in like a seismic shift is like, I think in any creative field, it's like if you have such a telescopic or tunnel vision approach to whatever field you're in, and for a very long time what you're taught in food is just like eat, breathe, living food. And what I kind of saw like coming up in like culinary school is just like a lot of people were just into nothing but food, like their whole life was food, right? Or not food necessarily, but this idea of being a chef,
right?
So their whole life was based around this idea of like I said earlier, like live by the fire, and which again to me just seemed like really nerdy, and that was kind of like the life I was surrounded. But the thing is, like in any creative field, it's just like I think the things that are most impressive to me are like those people that go beyond, just like they use essentially their chosen medium as a way to kind of like be a catalyst for like a lot of different passions.
I mean, I find that the most on the kind of most media ready level, that like I loved the latter seasons of Parts Unknown and David Chang's new show, just because I feel like they're not even really food shows anymore. They're culture shows and political shows, and like,
yeah,
you know, David Chang is very explicit about the racism behind all sorts of why certain foods are relevant and certain foods are not, and authenticity. But it's really like food is almost like it's that vehicle, but it's like an excuse to kind of get to talk about all these things and actually meet all these people, as opposed to just the kind of like pornographic photos and glossy things about the technical side of food or the beauty of food or the inaccessibility of really exquisite food. And it's interesting to see even just on like the Netflix food channels, like that changeover.
Yeah.
Where food becomes that cultural medium, I guess.
No, and that's where it's like, and that's what's great about what's happening to food too, is there can be a whole spectrum of all that. Because you have the shit that's just on like Food Network or network television that's like basic like ratings, and it's like
right.
White man Gordon Ramsay like yelling at people, or competition, or just right. A competition like shows where you're just like, why? Like, and then you can have like more, I don't know, just like artistic. Like, I mean, you've had a lot of like really amazing like food people on this program in particular. I mean, like Mold.
Yeah.
Like these people that are kind of like pushing the idea of what food can be. And it is like, I think it's funny because like to me, food, it could almost be like a Trojan horse,
right?
Of like, you're like, hey, come sit down and make you something.
No, exactly.
And then it's like, boom, like.
Let's talk about race.
You know, it's just like, yeah, let's talk about race. Which it doesn't have to always be all the time. And I think I'm starting to like see where the value isn't. I don't actually know. That's not true. I mean, it isn't like, it's just, it's a conversation, actually. That's what it is. It's just like, it's a Trojan horse for a conversation for a lot of things. And it is a really amazing tool that can be very stealth. And that's what I mean. So you don't have to like present something and be like, let's talk about colonialism. But you can plant a little seed in somebody's head that's like, hey, not like high food doesn't have to be some nouveau French shit. It can be a lot. It can be like some really funky tasting like fermentation from like Korea or Vietnam, or it could be you know, like the funny thing about the Caribbean too that I really love about this idea is that like to me the whole world is like represented in the culture and the food of the Caribbean, be it through spice trade routes or slavery or colonialism or indigenous kind of culture. It's like, it's all present. Like every single continent, I think, except Australia, is present in the Caribbean. And it's kind of wild. So it's like, you can see the whole history of the world. And I think that's what's kind of like interesting about food. So like whenever I'm drawn to like people in food, it's the people that get that and like are really stoked equally about food as they are something else, be it like fashion or art or politics or social justice or, you know, it's like, it's multidimensional and it's like multifaceted. And that to me is like way more interesting than, you know, just it purely being like, we're trying to get this award or this recognition in this like other dated kind of thing. Not to say that you can't be, you know, like awarded these older, I don't know, like accolades and it still not push those envelopes, because like there are a lot of amazing chefs that do just that.
Right.
But I just think the shift of like what it means to succeed in this industry and people kind of creating their own terms of like what that success means has been tremendous in like opening it up, I guess is what I'm saying.
So, I mean, obviously like this year, and it's not even over yet, you still have like a month and a half to go, has been like an incredible year and, you know, obviously due to your involvement with food and being a chef and stuff, but you didn't always want to be a chef, right? There was a point where you kind of switched over from.
Yeah. I mean, I was like before, cooking, I was just kind of like a bum, just bumming it around in bum town. I was just like a little shithead, I guess, that had no direction. I was doing photography a little bit and video work before all that, but then I moved to San Francisco and just kind of was being 20 in my 20s thing. And then I really just started cooking like, not even like, I think like 10 years ago, maybe even less, to be honest.
Do you remember why you, like when you first started cooking, were you already always cooking for yourself or for friends? Or was it just like, oh shit, I could try cooking just for the fun of it and then see where that goes?
Yeah, I mean, actually it was kind of like how I got into cooking was, it's actually funny. Okay, so I remember when I was younger, I would draw out like the restaurant I was going to open when I was like an adult, stuff like that. And I'm like, this is where this goes and that's where that goes. And I remember vividly drawing that. And then I would cook when I was younger. And then it was really just like all the things my grandma would make. I mean, this is the, what's it called? All the things, I mean, this is like typical for like all cooks, essentially. It's your grandma.
Right.
So it's like whatever my grandma used to make that I like was like, damn, that was so good. I haven't had that in a long time. I would be like, hey, can you teach me how to make that? And then we would make it and it was really great. And then I just kind of kept up with that. Also, I was like, I've always been in food. Like my first job at the age of 15 was working at the fair at like a food stand.
Which fair?
The San Diego, the Del Mar Fair.
Oh, sweet. I picked up trash there at the Del Mar Fair.
Oh shit. See, it's the ultimate summer job. Nobody from San Diego.
Which booth was it?
I mean,
it?
Nobody. Yeah. Okay. I actually worked for Hot Dog on a Stick.
That's all right. Like you wore the hat and everything.
There was a different male uniform.
Oh, that's true.
But, and also from there, I also kind of like, used to do, I guess, kind of like training videos and stuff like that. It's like a weird, that was just like a funny.
I think it's amazing.
I don't know if I actually like, as I'm saying it, I'm kind of like, I don't know if I want to divulge that necessarily, but it was a good time. And so I've always been in food. And then I was working front of the house in San Francisco because that's how you made some money. And at that time, you could live off of that. But I got kind of like bored. And also, I was hired as a busboy. So I kind of was always in the kitchen anyway. And then one day I was just like, I want to do this. So I did that.
So, So like, let's, I want to know like how, so you started working in the kitchen. This was still in San Francisco?
Yeah, my first job was in San Francisco in the kitchen. Or my first kitchen job, sorry, was in San Francisco at this place called Ticou's. That was French. It's kind of like, I don't know, if anybody's from San Francisco and they, at this time, like, it was a pretty notorious place. It was like open for 20 years. It was Breton, like food from Brittany. Huh. So it was like Celtic French food, and it was like buckwheat crepes and pate and seafood and all that kind of shit. But it was very, it was ran by this really amazing woman who was like very like French, like world music. Mm. So it was like, it was kind of, I don't know. There's just like a lot of Manu Chao playing.
Right.
I remember specifically, if that describes anything. Totally. And then that's kind of like my first job. And then I went to Napa to cooking school and did that.
Oh, okay.
And so I forget where we were leading with this. But no, yeah,
it's,
I guess,
just kind of like the mechanics really of getting into the food industry.
You know what? You know, okay, so this is what I would say to anybody that's younger, because I just think about this all the time, like especially like how I've managed to like do all the things that I've done. And I feel very lucky and blessed. And to me, they seem like normal, but to a lot of people, I guess it's like pretty unconventional. It's just like, no matter what, like everything's an opportunity to just kind of like observe shit. And if it seems like useless or pointless or like whatever now, like 15 years from now or 20 years from now, like to have that kind of like continuation of just like slowly collecting data or information. Do you know what I mean?
So how did, like, sorry, go ahead.
I guess it's just like, that's kind of like how I feel like I've been able to succeed at certain things, was just right. Like literally by observing stuff and then understanding what people kind of wanted.
Right. How did, from San Francisco to Napa to eventually, like how did, was El Rey the first restaurant that you were part of the opening of or that opened?
Wait, say that again, that we cut out for
it. Sorry, was El Rey the first restaurant that you opened? Or first kind of
yeah,
like
I mean,
place,
I worked at
cafe?
I worked at other places, and like El Rey was kind of like a funny transition because it like it came out of nowhere. But I was a sous chef at a place before that in the East Village, and then when I came on to El Rey, I was just signed on essentially to be the baker and do baked goods, and I was really passionate about learning all that kind of stuff because I was mainly a savory cook at that point, but like. I think the interesting thing about that was that like I got to learn from somebody who was essentially a master in like pastry and dessert and all that kind of stuff. But then I got to apply my palate more to it, which was like a little bit savory. So there was like interesting things that I was proud of that kind of set the tone for what El Rey would become, which was like making a salted plum Danish with like ginger glaze, I think was one of the first things that I kind of did. And all these like quick breads and like, they were all kind of very simple desserts, but it was more like a vehicle for that
right.
flavor profile. So that's kind of how I started in that. But then little known fact, coffee shops really don't make that much money. so anybody who's thinking about it.
Don't do it for the money.
Consider this. consider this little story. So coffee shops have very high margins, I guess, where it's just kind of like there's the cost of goods for good quality coffee and good quality milk is just really expensive. So what it means is that you just have to have kind of a line out the door all the time in order for you to make, even if you only have like two employees and it's a tiny ass place, which El Rey was. But in order to kind of turn that around, we decided to, like the pastries were being pretty well received as far as like the flavor profiles, and they were kind of like interesting at that time. So we decided to throw in a lunch counter and we built out like the tiniest kitchen ever, which was just like a half sheet oven, a hot plate, and like, I forget what other bullshit I had, but it was just like a very tiny, tiny space. And that's kind of what happened. That's how El Rey kind of came around. It was just like, it was totally unexpected.
And practical, kind of.
Yeah, it was, yeah. But it did tap in kind of at the right time, right place. Uh-huh. So this is the moral of that. It's like anybody who's ever like, I'm going to open a coffee shop, I'm kind of like, good luck with it. Because yeah. I always use myself as a reference. Like, honestly, I wouldn't be where I was or where I am now if coffee shops made money.
Did you see, so what I'd love to hear is like, you said you were a sous chef somewhere before LA. What restaurant was that?
It was this place called Goat Town.
In the East Village?
Yeah, it became like Gigi's, and it was the same owner.
Oh, right, right.
El Rey, yeah.
Okay. So that, I guess that was the next question, is that what was that connection from there to El Rey? But I guess the ownership knew of you, obviously.
Yeah.
Got it.
That was it.
When you started as the pastry chef at El Rey, did you see yourself at that point being like, all right, I'm just kind of moving through the gears, and I'm now going to, like, eventually I'm going to run my own thing, or I'm going to be an executive chef here or there? Or were you just kind of like, this is cool, let's just try this?
It was definitely the second. Yeah. Like, that's kind of my approach for a lot of things in life, which keeps things pretty open-ended. But I will say this. Before, at the time when I started El Rey, it was funny. I was working at this place. Like, I was moonlighting at this place called Achilles Heel way back before they really had, like, a chef driven kind of program there. And I was just like, literally just there. It's this bar in Greenpoint. And I was just like plating charcuterie and like making little salads and stuff like that. Nothing like crazy, but this is how it was. Like when I started El Rey, I would go bake at El Rey at like, I'm trying to think of the timeline and stuff like that of the day. Like I would go bake in the afternoon at like 4 o'clock until like 8 o'clock PM. So 4 p.m. to 8 p.m., then I would bike in the winter to, or like fall winter to Achilles Heel and work a shift from like 8 to midnight. And then I would bike back to Gigi's or Goat Town where we were baking everything. And then I would stay there till like from midnight to like 3 a.m. kind of thing. But this was all like self-driven because right. like I just really was passionate about it. So at that time, though, I would for sure say that, like, I didn't give a shit about, I didn't know anything about really the food scene in New York at all. Like, I didn't read any magazines. I didn't read the New York Times. I didn't read, like, anything food related. I was seriously just, like, in this world of, like, when I moved to New York, I was like, I'm just going to concentrate on cooking. I was sober for the first part when I got here and, like, fully just, like, I think I had a friend that had a Pilates studio and she was learning how to teach. So she would just teach it on me. And it was just like a very healthy, focused life that I had. That was kind of like my 20s were just like, I was just farting around. So I just wanted to turn myself around. And it was just like, it was literally, it was like self-care without even knowing what that was. It was before that vocabulary was part of my life. And so when I started El Rey, I had no idea any of that world. I didn't have like a smartphone. I wasn't on Instagram. It was just like very, I was just a completely different, like, I don't even say it was like naive. It was just like, I was doing my own thing. Mm-hmm. And then El Rey just kind of exploded and like I was introduced to that whole world and dynamic. So I guess what I'm trying to say more so is that when I started at El Rey, there was never any intention for it to like
right.
became what it became. Like I it wasn't like I was like, we're gonna get, like when we were building the lunch counter, I wasn't like, we're gonna be in every magazine and newspaper and get reviewed in the New York Times like twice, and like I'm gonna be on a billboard and
you're like, I've made it. My kid and I'm gonna childhood cook. Dream.
Yeah. I never, like, that was never my intention. And I think maybe that's kind of why it was successful, yeah. because it was just like unexpected and was coming from a very pure place.
Do you remember, well, actually, I had a question I wanted to ask before. Have you introduced or cooked any of your grandma's dishes in your restaurants, like directly?
I have. A number of times, actually, and they're always very personal, and I'm always like just really excited about them.
Are they still on a menu anywhere? Like, can I go order it today?
No, I don't think so. I mean, a lot of the times too, like I'll make stuff that's more like special event kind of thing. Mm. Like I've been throwing this party since last year, actually. It's called Tres Leches, which is, it's a buffet / DJed event where it's kind of a celebration of what it means to be Latino or Latinx in 2018, as I describe it. But it's essentially a vehicle where like we try to recreate what the type of vibe and food that we ate at like family gatherings and stuff like that. Mm. So that's one vehicle for a lot of it.
Are you, were you born and raised in San Diego?
Yeah.
Did you have, was there anybody like in your family or that you saw that was a professional chef or cook?
No, I mean, no, actually everybody was kind of involved in construction, to be honest, like in one form or another. Like, my dad was a general contractor, and then divided amongst my uncles were the other vocational stuff. Like one was a plumber, one was an electrician, one was, you know, like that kind of stuff.
Right.
But no, there wasn't really anybody like professionally cooking that I can remember.
Do you remember why you were saying at some point you were already as a kid drawing out your restaurant that you were going to have when you were older? Do you have any idea like where that interest in being a chef, I mean, at that age before you even probably considered professionally how to do it?
I haven't really dug deep into it, but I'm sure there's like an answer there where it's like, I was like an extremely introverted, socially awkward, socially anxious kid. Huh. Like I couldn't really go to parties because I would always like freak out and be like, I have to get out of here. But you know what? Actually, now that I think about it, the thing that I love about cooking and throwing parties is that you're involved, but you have always an excuse to dip. Like, oh, I have to go in the kitchen really quick and check on. And then there's always like a conversational piece. So maybe it's just like, maybe secretly I just use cooking to make people like me.
It was like a good way to be part of the party, but like, not
yeah, big. I'm like, here, I'm going to give you something and then I'm going to walk away and we're not going to talk and you're going to think I'm really cool and nice.
Yeah. And you'll think about me a lot, but I don't have to talk to you.
Yeah,
I won't be there.
But I don't have to talk to you. No, seriously.
No, it's awesome. I totally, I'm laughing because I'm like, oh, I can totally identify with that.
Yeah, no, totally. It's just like, I mean, for sure. It's funny because I still will use that excuse sometimes. Like I'll be like, oh, I'm just really socially awkward. And I remember my ex would be like, no, you're not. Like, or everybody's like, what are you talking about? Like that's the last thing that they would describe me. But there was a point when that was a big part. A lot of anxiety.
Were you, what neighborhood did you grow up in San Diego?
I grew up kind of East County, but actually like formatively, I would say Logan Heights, because that's where the center of my universe is, which is my grandmother's house.
Okay.
And what's that?
I was going to say, is that a predominant kind of Hispanic or Latin American community?
Yes. I mean, I know you're asking me this because probably 99.9% of the listeners are not from San Diego, right. But it's essentially, it's kind of an interesting neighborhood because it's not just like Little Mexico or what you would call like something like that. It was the, one of the major points in like the Chicano movement. So like there is hella like Mexican families everywhere. And like the church that my whole life is kind of like centered around, Our Lady of Guadalupe, is like, if you go there, there's always like tamales and like different stands that are always around like vendors and stuff like that. So there's a part of it that feels very much like entrenched in like Mexican culture. However, there is a big like Chicano, which is like a Mexican American kind of, or Latinx like movement. That's just kind of like, more about, I don't know, I guess it's kind of like, it's a funny thing. So it's like, there was, I'll give you a little backstory, if that's all right.
Yeah, please.
So it was a neighborhood. And then two things happened that the county of the city of San Diego did. One, they put the 5 freeway directly in the middle of it. So they built a freeway going through like the heart of this neighborhood. And then two, one side of the freeway, they rezoned as an industrial zoning. And it just was really, it just disregarded a lot of people that had lived there.
It was previously residential, I take it.
It was all for the most part, it was previously residential. The Bay, I mean, it does go out to the Bay, and that was always kind of industrial from what I understand, but to the extent in which they rezoned it, it was kind of crazy. So essentially, it was directly outside of downtown, and they did that, and then the city, I think, had promised, I think they either had promised to make a park, or they went through where it was supposed to be a park, so the neighborhood kind of like uprised a little bit, and they turned much like, I guess, like People's Park in Berkeley, like these kind of like people taking back land that was taken away from them from like a local government. Right. Like that. They took back the land directly underneath this freeway because it's like all overpasses essentially. So it wasn't just like a normal ass freeway. It was just like a giant like overpass with a bunch of other like arteries going to other freeways and stuff like that. So they went underneath and they pretty much like took over these like near Chicano Park, and it's like every square inch has like a mural painted on it that tells the history of like Mexican Americans. So that's kind of like, that's where I grew up.
Do you remember, cause like growing
or
up,
that's where like, that's where the, like, I would say like the center. I also grew up in like East County, San Diego, which is a little bit further out. And that's like when my parents kind of, we moved to different parts of San Diego, eventually settling in like my childhood home, which is more like East San Diego. But I would say that the center of like what I would consider is like Logan Heights,
right.
Julian Avenue at Cesar Chavez.
I guess like what I'm curious about, it seems really interesting is, and like we talked about a little bit before with just generally where cooking is moving to or where food is now, but like with your restaurants, but also your food, it does seem super personal and very much tied to just sort of like, there's like, it's like a direct representation of you and your identity, not only ethnically, but just kind of like your personality, obviously. And I think that was something that, I just find fascinating where that, it's a funny way to say it, but like that kind of confidence in exhibiting your identity, you know, comes from, especially I think with minority kids, there's a kind of common break, I feel like, with, okay, do I sort of be more American in a way, or classically American, or do I actually just kind of dive back into my background and actually find something really unique in that? And obviously, especially with food, there's a lot of, you know, Angelo's, again, another example, but a lot of really interesting chefs that are actually, this is like what my family is and did, and I'm just like exploring it again and doing it in a different way, but very proud of that ethnic background, I guess.
Yeah.
So I was just kind of curious, like, obviously you grew up in a neighborhood, it sounds like you grew up in a neighborhood that was very strong for your background.
Molding, yeah.
Yeah, did you have a period, especially as you started getting into food, where you moved away from that, either deliberately or kind of like subconsciously, and you're like, oh, actually maybe like I need to be more French, or I need to be more whatever it is that food is kind of classically expecting you to be?
Not really.
That's great.
Not if I were to think about it. Awesome. No, because like the funny thing is like of course we were like taught all that stuff, but that was just more like foundational. I always kind of viewed it in that kind of sense, because like I'm always like, there's something that's like outwardly like, oh, that's typically, but that's Mexican through and through, you know, whatever that means. That's like, that's a specific dish, for instance, But then there's the things that are a little bit more internal that I always thought were kind of fascinating, which is like, there's actually a palette and a profile of what makes this feel so at home, which for me, that's like Southern California, coastal Mexican, which is like literally every food, whether it's like a dessert or the savory dish, has the same five palate qualities, which is like, there's like savory, sweet, spicy, sour, and salty. And that's like for both candies and normal ass dishes. It's just a matter of like what's more intense, like the sugar content or like the salt content or the sour content. But those are always present. And I think, if you know, like from other cultures around the world, that's like a similar thing too, which is like, I guess, South Asia, Southeast Asia, you can kind of get that same flavor profile, maybe a little bit differently, but so I guess what I'm saying is like there's the external cues of like this is through and through Mexican, and there's the internal ones, and that's kind of like what I always try to explore in my food, either subconsciously or consciously. There's always that kind of balance in my head that is definitely not like a Eurocentric kind of approach to it, but it's what I'm used to. And it's kind of like, to me, that like equates as like very fresh and like coastal, which is what I always kind of gravitate towards.
Do you see yourself go ahead.
No, go for it.
I was going to say, do you see yourself ever opening something in San Diego?
I would love to down the line. Hmm. But I went to LA for the first time in a very long time recently, this past summer, and had the raddest experience. And then I took the train from LA to San Diego, which was very, the Surfliner. It was rad. It was like $30 and it was like 2 hours, and you're not sitting in traffic and you're looking at the ocean. And I was like, maybe I'll just move to LA at some point, not right away, but like, and then eventually move down towards San Diego. Cause despite my history of not having lived there essentially since I was 17, I actually really do love my family, and and everything I do is an extension of my love for them. And
I mean, you have found a way to get closer to the ocean right now.
Yeah, that's I mean, honestly, I'm just realizing that, like, maybe this is a very San Diego thing too, but it's like salt, salt water, and like sun, and like we also
Gerardo?
Honda CRV, and so I'm like driving around in that, listening to music is very, it feels very natural, like my natural state to be in a hot car listening to music.
Hopefully I'll get a chance to come down there soon and try. I've never tried any of the new stuff that you're working on, so I'm like really excited to get a chance to try it.
Yeah, I'm excited too. I think it's interesting because like there are certain like, I don't know. The great thing, I guess, is there doesn't have to be a real like direct path, and like even detours I'm always very excited about because they're chances to kind of just like explore a different side of yourself. And I think for this, I feel like I'm just so excited about cooking food and like cutting out the noise of as much as I love New York, it became very noisy for me in like a distracting kind of way of like what is actually really important to me. And I think this will be a time where I can actually just like focus on really amazing like ingredients and like explore different like foods and like maybe let go of things that I always held on to or try to perfect those kind of things. But I'm very excited about it. I'm very excited to get like bored and run out of things to do.
Just sit around for a while.
Yeah, because I think it's important. Like every 6 years or so, you got to put yourself in those situations.
Well, San Diego's good for that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why, because it feels natural and at home. But
thanks. Cool. Congrats on a gnarly 2018.
No. 2019.
Into 2019. And thanks for calling in, of course. And
thank you. I mean, one of the cool things about 2018 is just I've got to meet a lot of really amazing people that are doing things that are not only like creatively, like, I think, major, but also personally passionate. So, and you are one of them, and I thank you for inviting me.
Awesome. Thank you, Gerardo. It's very nice. All right. Well, I'll see you hopefully on the beach soon. All right. I'll take it easy.
Bye.
See ya.